The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
It's time for the John DePietro Show here on News Talk, WNRI, 1380 AM and 99.9 and 95.1 FM.
He's a special kind of sentinel.
Mr. DePietro, who is in the eye of the storm.
Suddenly, John DePietro became the story.
Radio talk show host, John DePietro.
And welcome to the lunchtime. Hey, good afternoon, one and all. Here I am. It's Juan. It's John DePietro. This portion of our program brought to you by Ryan's Appliance Repair. Remember what we say. What's that? Your appliance is dying? Hey, just call Ryan. 401-710-7096. I'll provide an example. We went to use the oven. Somehow when we used the self-cleaning portion, you know, self-cleaning oven, well, it blew out something. So what did I do? Did I panic? No. Did I try to fix it? Don't be ridiculous. No, I called Ryan's Appliance Repair. 401-710-7096. Ryan said, Juan, I'll be there at 9 o'clock. At 5 of 9, I looked out in the driveway right in front of my home. What did it say? A van appeared, a truck that said Ryan's Appliance Repair. If your appliance is dying, just call Ryan. He came in. He fixed the oven, I'm going to say about 10 minutes. It's never worked better. Call them today, 401-710-7096. All work is guaranteed for 90 days, parts and labor. Senior citizens discount is available, whether it's a oven or your stove or refrigerator or washer, dryer, dishwasher, microwave oven. If your appliance needs to be repaired, call Ryan's Appliance Repair, 401-710-7096. Folks, let's bring him on. He is the managing editor of OceanStateCurrent.com. We want to say good afternoon and welcome one again to our friend Justin Katz. Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, John. Great to be with you again.
Justin, I want to start off. Providence Journal did an interview with Governor Raimondo, and she's talking about various priorities, and we're going to touch on it a little bit. But one of the things that stood out to me was it's just so out of hand, where you and I both know that the budget that's going to be coming up that she's going to then submit is going to be well over $10 billion. I mean, it basically was $10 billion last year, but they tried to be cute and kind of be below that. But anyhow, yet the state, with all of that money, the state is facing a $200 million deficit. And all that jumps out is she's just, you know, her attitude is basically always, we need more money.
Well, yeah, I mean, she claims it as we have to make our difficult decisions, but for some reason, difficult decisions always mean more revenue for the government. Like we're now taxing online sales, for example. That's not enough. So now we've got to find something else. And when in doubt, she goes to specific things. So she wants to find more money for affordable housing. That was one of the things she says we need to just find cash for. But that should worry Rhode Islanders. First of all, I mean, we all know we're already overtaxed, and that's causing problems in our economic, our business environment, in our affordability for families. And so now new taxes for this, for that, to fund for, you know, DCYF or whatever they're claiming shortfalls in, and now affordable housing, which could mean more, who knows, a statewide licensing fee. I mean, we're still dealing with the problems of the truck-only tolls, which was one of her more recent attempts to find new revenue. So that should worry Rhode Islanders, and it's going to be one of the big fear points, I think, with the next budget is, so you want another couple hundred million dollars, where are you going to come up with it? Because she's signaling that she doesn't want to reduce any spending, and that's the problem.
Here's some of the journal stories. State budget analysts projecting $180 million, $200 million gap between revenues and spending. Said she cannot rule out tax fee hikes. We need some money. Camp Ballard's a budget, $200 million in the hole, without doing some difficult things for what it's worth. If state agencies were given all the money they say they need next year, the state-funded portion of the budget would increase by more than $177 million. Justin, how about this? We really squeezed Medicaid. It's a third of our budget, getting harder and harder. She drew a line at the proposal by the progressives that want to raise the top marginal income tax rate in Rhode Island's highest earners from 6% to 11%. But Justin, here's the thing. You and I could go through. I think it's one of those things that they don't like to deal with it, but it's not as if there's a line item that you're ever going to cross out that would be worth $100 million. But all of these jobs that are given out, all of these spokespeople, all of the, you know, every department has some kind of spokesperson on it. I think Kathy Gregg kind of figured it out, and that came to, like, it was somewhere in the vicinity, I think, believe, over $4 million. And then if no one talks about the fact that one of the biggest ways they could save money, if they wanted to, and we're talking about saving money for, I'm talking about what you pay to compare to what you could, you know, could be paying. Capital TV. Now, if Capital TV was outsourced, I don't know what the full budget is for Capital TV, but it's a who's who of politically connected people. They're only in session January to June. Yet Capital TV, those are year-round, full-time jobs, full perks, full benefits. I'll bet if you said to an outsource to a private production company for what they wanted, I'm willing to bet that it would probably be, you know, like 20% of the cost of what it is. My point is, between the jobs that Mattiello gives out, to every time you hear about another person with the state police, whatever, then they're retiring at a certain age and everybody getting the full pension and everything, it's not one thing. You know, as I was saying, it's not as if you could say, all right, let's cross out this line of $100 million. But it's just collectively, for her to have that kind of a budget, and you and I both know New Hampshire operates on a budget, same state of size of Rhode Island as far as residents, and New Hampshire's budget is about $6 billion. I think they're beyond the point of even recognizing how much the spending is so out of control.
I think they're beyond the point of even looking at or even thinking that that's a possibility, by definition almost, that you cannot be spending out of control because government should always spend more. It's like an article of faith. I think in that interview, one of the more telling things to me was, as I mentioned, the idea that they're going to find some kind of dedicated stream for housing. And what that reminded me of, apart from truck tolls, was a few years ago, they were pushing for $300,000. I think they were trying to come up with $300,000 basically to fund the nonprofit Rhode Island Coalition for Domestic Violence, I think is the name. And what they wanted to do to make a dedicated revenue stream for this private organization was to put a $46 fee on all marriage licenses. So it was almost an offensive concept. You know, we're going to tax marriage in order to pay for domestic violence. But the concept was so offensive that they couldn't get it over the line. So what they do 3 years ago, they just created a line item in a budget for $300,000. Now, it's not a whole lot, but it kind of shows how here's this thing. They wanted to find a dedicated revenue stream for it. They couldn't, and so they just put it in a budget. And there's tons and tons of these building up to that total amount. It makes me think of a number of the reports that the Center for Freedom and Prosperity has put out. I mean, some years ago, we were, for all the various projects we were trying to find funding for, such as school choice, we went through the budget and found like $250 million pretty easily. It wasn't, you know, we didn't hire a team of accountants to comb through the budget. It was all right there. And that's whether you're, you know, we've got a nuclear facility, for example, that's entirely a museum for the most part at this point. That's getting $1 million. And you add all that up, and then you start looking at, as you say, all of the PR people who don't, you know, millions of dollars there. And then you start looking at the union contracts and all of the additional cost of that. And the center last year estimated, and we're starting to approach $1 billion of excess there, that if we would just allow some market dynamics rather than the collective bargaining, we could save cities and towns and in turn the state directly. Those things add up huge. Whether we could get down to, you know, New Hampshire level of fiscal prudence, that would be a longer term project. But to find $200 million, we do not need any more revenue streams. It's right there if the governor and the legislature will look for it. But then they have to start giving up their little, you know, all of those little $300,000 here, $1 million there. That has all added up to, one, protecting themselves with PR folks, for example, and two, handing out benefits for voter constituencies, and that's what that $10 billion is buying.
And what about Justin? Her another part of and again, folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. Speak with Justin Katz, managing editor, OceanStateCurrent.com. This was an article that Governor Raimondo did with the Providence Journal when asked about plan as far as a fee on fuel. And what does she say? Well, you know, needs to be figured out. But what her message about Rhode Island drivers? We have to get off gas-guzzling cars. Starts talking about climate change. Said there's benefits to consumers. The money will result in faster electric trains, more electric forms of busing, and public transit. I don't want to raise the gas tax, but we have to wean ourselves from fossil fuels. Justin, Rhode Island, I mean, how many times have we talked about this? We don't have a public transportation reliable element set up. It isn't. There are major cities where you could push for more of that. You know, some of the larger cities, maybe even, you know, Boston is trying to deal with it. But for her, for Governor Mundo, I just wonder, like, are they living in reality? It's one thing to say something at a rally or in front of a group of Sunrise or whoever, and then you have to go into, like, the real world and what that would do. It hurts consumers. People in this part of the country, in the state, we drive places. People don't take public transportation. There's not even enough buses and things to do that if they want to. It doesn't even make sense. If I, over the weekend, wanted to go Christmas shopping at Warwick Mall, I mean, if I ever, it wouldn't even occur to me. So what? I don't even know where the bus stop is near my house anymore. I mean, I stopped taking public transportation in Rhode Island when I used to take a bus to high school. And I lived in New York and you take the subway, but we're not built that way. It's not designed that way. When you try to do, anyone that tries to use public transportation, it's really not that convenient. But she's still going to push to try to add on this gas tax that I know the, you know, Sten and the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity have been warning people about.
Yeah, well, that's the Transportation and Climate Initiative. And what's kind of scary is that she felt free to kind of just come right out and say the line you quoted. You know, we've got to get off of gas-guzzling cars for the existence of us, which translates into, I want to take your car away and give you an electric-powered bus. So, well, gee, thanks. And that's not really going to be helpful when you can't find work in Rhode Island and have to commute to Boston or commute to Framingham, where I used to work, or Connecticut or somewhere. It's completely disconnected from the lives that people actually live. And just to clarify what she's talking about here, she's starting to send signals, I think, that she does not think she needs legislative approval to join this TCI, which is the regional cooperative that's going to be imposing an effective tax on all Rhode Islanders. It's just a very aggressive way to change policies in the service, now she's admitting, of this ideology that we just have too much freedom with our cars and we need to get rid of these gas guzzling cars. And it's just it's another way to implement a political progressive program, which is increasingly her focus. I mean, I looked at, she also refers in the article to her continued fundraising, and she wants to have a war chest of $1 million, even though she's not running for any office. And if you look at her campaign finance since the last election, the percentage of her money that's coming from out of state is now up to 54%, and the average donation is up about 25-30%, which is just about $600. So what you're seeing is a lot of wealthy people out of state, in particular, maxing out their donations to her, and a lot of it is to force through this kind of ideological agenda. And one of that is to raise the taxes on gasoline. It makes you wonder about the claim of a deficit, right? So on one hand, she's talking about how the state needs to find some money. And on the other hand, she's kind of downplaying a gas tax, not so much as a tax, but as a punitive measure to take away cars. It makes you wonder how much the state's tax burden is more of a punitive measure to prevent people from being economically productive.
Justin, on top of that, this is a quote from Governor Raimondo. I have a job to do and I have things that I know Rhode Islanders want and deserve. And here's what she lists. Investments in education, pre-K, gun safety. Now, I speak with a lot of people. And Justin Katz, if you took, you know, if there was a focus group done and you really said to people, what are your priorities? I don't think any of those three come in to the top 10. First of all, gun safety. I don't hear anyone truly in Rhode Island talking about gun safety. In other parts of the country, it's almost customary that when a kid turns 18, they immediately go out and, like, for their 18th birthday, they get a weapon. They get a rifle and a gun and that type of thing. We don't have that around here. As far as investments in education, I don't even know what that means anymore. If that means her free tuition at CCRI, none of that matters if children are graduating from certain high schools and can't even read. I don't believe it's very striking to me that this was someone who was just reelected last November, and I don't in any way see her priorities in line with the priorities of the state. It still comes back to people need jobs. People want jobs that their children can get, good companies, so families can stay together and work here. And you know, I really don't even care what she thinks about vaping, and I don't know how much of the problem that is, but I don't believe her, what she views as priorities, I don't think in any way it aligns with what regular, normal people that are trying to live and work and live productive lives in the state, I don't think the priorities mesh.
No, not at all. And in fact, when you said that, I quickly looked up. In February, there was mainly around the topic of abortion, but there was a lot of debate about the top priorities of Rhode Islanders. And there were a few surveys at the time, and education's always at the top of the list, but that doesn't mean more spending necessarily. That probably means reform. But up there at the top, always, on every list, jobs and the economy, lowering taxes, and combating government corruption. There's nothing about guns or whatever else the governor wants to claim, a universal pre-K. These are not priorities. These are her priorities, and as I said a few minutes ago, they're the priorities of activist groups and high-income ideologues who are willing to fund a governor to go out and advocate for their interests, not the interests of Rhode Islanders. But there's not a whole lot new about this. I mean, in some ways, it comes down to the story of her election, where you see a lot of big money donors. Not a lot of popular support for her in any survey, and yet she wins the election. It's because she's serving a narrow group of special interests who will fund her campaigns and help her along into a national spotlight. And I see again online, or in the news, reporters citing the possibility of her as a vice presidential candidate, because what was it? The Washington Post, I think, was saying she would round out a number of tickets in different ways at the national level. So somebody, that doesn't just happen. Somebody nationally is pushing her to be seen that way, and it's all because she is now a governor taking this outside money in order to promote of the priorities of the people who can put her on that ticket. And I think that's been the story we've been seeing since last November, and it's getting hard to deny.
Yeah, I don't know how clear, and I'm glad you pick up on that. Those things don't just happen. Someone is pushing that narrative. Someone is pushing that to a columnist or someone at the Washington Post. Throw her name around. She wants to be involved with the 2020 election for president, and then she wants to move on. Her job is done. For her to even say, well, with Mattiello, we get along. It's nothing personal. No one believes that. And as far as nothing personal, the fighting that goes back and forth with her in the speaker's office, where she's begging for more money, she doesn't get it, so she rats him out on the $1 million to the chiropractor, and then he takes a shot back at Smiley because then he's threatening Twin River. It's totally counterproductive. But you're exactly right. Anyone that, if you're listening to her, she will do everything she has to and is really looking to just try to move on. I would be very surprised. Now, if a Democrat wins the White House, I would be shocked if she actually finished out her term. I think she has no interest in it. She feels she's gotten what she wants out of it. I want to touch on also, there was a story about the Providence schools. And as much as people are saying, it's not that bad, the budget deficit isn't as large as everyone thought it was going to be. Even Governor Mundo says it's certainly not a matter of money. They have plenty of money. But to me, there are some things that jump out, such as it's way out of whack. I'm going to read right from Dan McGowan. The city pays 40% more per pupil than the median cost. Anyone who's lived through the bus strike knows. So they pay 40% more than per pupil than other districts. And first student, blah, blah, blah. And then when it comes to custodial service, the company believes Providence spends 25% more than the median in other districts. Justin Katz, to me, right there, I mean, that, I don't know all the specifics, but when you're talking about busing 40% more, custodial service 25% more, that's a form of corruption. What possibly, and we're not talking small money. When you're talking a huge number of schools and everything else, those are big numbers that we're talking about. But why does it take an audit to even figure that out?
the point about the deficit being smaller, I think, is one that raises that question for me. Why do we need an audit for this? I mean, it's pretty clear that all of the districts and state and local government generally overstates their needs in order at the local level to put pressure on the state to give them more aid and the local taxpayers to fund more. So you're going to say, oh, we've got a $22 million deficit. So you bring in an auditor and he says, actually, that's more like $3 million maybe, but then you've got all these other costs that are artificially high. And so it's not just busing and custodial services. The report also cites pension and retiree healthcare as inordinately high in Providence. And that it goes to a point a lot of us have made for a long time, that our education system has become a jobs program, not focused on children.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's not in any way. And that's why when she even talks about education funding, I don't even know what that means anymore, because we know the amount of money, and it's certainly not going into the classroom. It's not going into anything. What's also disappointing, you know, that we learned last week, the new education commissioner, as much as she's trying to, you know, she came out and I think she's been focused too much on Providence. Frankly, I talk to a lot of people. I'm tired of hearing about Providence. Most of the people, I don't really know. It's a very small number of people that send their children that are listening to you and I right now that send their children to public schools in Providence. It's been this thing that the schools are terrible. You can't send them there. It's not geared. Nothing has changed. Nothing. And you were exactly right. You had predicted that. But I talked with someone. I even talked to Dan McGowan. I mean, nothing has changed in the schools between now and the end of and Christmas. The amount of absenteeism of teachers would be huge. How about the education commissioner goes into a classroom and the teacher's learning geometry with the students? I mean, it is just a joke. But I also, it goes back to Governor Raimondo. She knew the situation with the schools when she lives in Providence. She became the new governor in 2015. She opted to send her children to private school. She could have tried to do this reform of the Providence schools in 2015. Instead, she chose that Ken Wagner, who basically didn't do anything and didn't have any power. She got rid of Deborah Giss, meaning Raimondo did. And I here it is, you know, going to be 5 years later, and I don't see, other than it was a lot of talk this summer, there's been no talk about any change right now that is going on in the Providence schools. And this is going to lead right into what I have said from the get-go. This is still going to come down to a big fight and showdown between the teachers' unions and this education commissioner the moment that she tries to alter any form of that contract.
Right. We feel like we're in the sort of the warm-up to this. We're, you know, yep, the match right before the boxing really begins, they go in circles and kind of jab at each other a little bit to warm up. We're kind of in that phase, and the real question is whether the education commissioner is actually going to take a swing at something, and then what's going to happen, particularly with the governor. I mean, you put your finger on it. When Governor Raimondo came in, she put the final nail in Deborah Gist's professional coffin in Rhode Island, which Governor Chafee had really built and shoved her into. And then she brought in Wagner, and it was really a go-along, get-along thing, because she needed at that point the teachers' union to get elected. That's what it comes down to. And so part of the question is now, when as she looks toward her national reputation, is it better to keep that comfort level with the teachers' unions, or is it better to be seen as a real reformer again? And I guess we'll see. And on a note of nothing changing, but what I found striking over the summer, there was a lot of mea culpa, you know, and apparent soul reflection, even from, say, Linda Borg of the Providence Journal's education writer, saying, oh, a lot of it, we all knew I think was her line, but you know, we just didn't do anything about
That's
it.
That's right.
Now they've just turned around and they're not making any real changes, just hoping it'll go away. And that it probably will. It's going to come down to Infanti Green really and how much she's willing to stake on the ability to bring about change in Rhode Island.
Yeah. And on top of that, again, all intentions, but then her initial power is when you first come in. And nothing has been implemented. T-traps and teaism is still huge. She is going around. I just wonder how much longer she's even having trouble hiring someone. Never mind. How about she lives in Central Falls and came out and someone had stolen all the tires off her car? I don't know why this woman makes, what, $250,000? And I don't know why she's living in Central Falls, sends her kids to private school in East Providence. But at some point, you're the most power you have is in the very beginning when you start off, most of the time. If you look at coaches or different politicians, it's that very beginning, you know, when they highlight it with the president, the first 100 days is when you really try to put things in motion, because then after that, different controversies come up, different things happen, and you don't have the type of momentum and juice and power you have like you have in the beginning. And I think now, whether she realizes or not, it's just going to start to become a little bit of a ho-hum, and that's exactly what they want, and they'll wait her out. And what are the unions doing? Are the unions doing anything to try to improve education scores in Rhode Island? No, they're already going after the different cities and towns to try to get them to toss the lawsuit because they have they're going to challenge the whole forever contract provision. So for all of that talk of everybody's going to be on board, we got to have a seat at the table, blah, 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 they certainly haven't done anything. No, she hasn't done anything. I know the teacher contract is up, but I think so far you are exactly right. I was fooled. I mean, we're coming into almost Christmas. I was fooled in the summertime thinking, now this is someone who's talking a big game, and she certainly seems serious about, you know, trying to get some things accomplished. But so far, other than a lot of interviews, a lot of talk about everyone getting together, it was even echoed on the national front. If you saw Elizabeth Warren, how about her saying that it's really the parents to blame for poor public schools, because you should go there and volunteer, and you don't pull your kid out of the school. You got to get more involved. It's really up to the parents. I'll tell you, Justin, it is frightening how little they actually care about education, and it really is just about jobs.
I wonder if the new commissioner is starting to get a sense of that from Rhode Island. I mean, in fairness, it really is difficult. In order to avoid what you just talked about with, you know, you need that first burst of energy to get anything done, in order to actually build up energy and maybe start at a lower and longer-term improvement, reformation, you need to find new constituencies and get them newly active. And that's very hard for somebody coming from out of state be put in a position. So she may have every intention, but she may have come in thinking, I'm going to get more support from the governor to actually find these constituencies that I need.
Right.
In that regard, Elizabeth Warren's comment is almost correct. It's not so much that, you know, you need to go in your school and not take your children out of it, which she actually did as a parent, taking her kids out of public schools, Elizabeth Warren. But it's about providing support to the people who will bring about the reform, and like the education commissioner. So if people begin to show up at meetings or even communicate with her that we're behind you as parents in Rhode Island, that would be a big boost. But unless that happens, which, you know, there's reason to be skeptical, unless that happens, it will fall right back into that rut. And it's going to be a question of whether for her professional and life intentions, she wants to be seen as a flame-throwing reformer, which is what's needed, or if she'll just say, well, I want to do as much good as I can, so let me reevaluate and reassess in the actual environment of Rhode Island education. And that's going to be the problem if that's the option, because Rhode Island's environment for reforming public education is terrible.
Terrible.
It's designed over and over, as we've talked about for months and months, everything down to, you know, probably file folders of photographs of mice in classrooms that
yep.
you can whip out. Everything is designed to make the energy for change go away. And that's what we're going to see, and we'll see it ramping up more and more as we get to elections, and then particularly the next governor's election.
Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. Our segment is Political Monday. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor, OceanStateCurrent.com. Justin, there's a good story on the front page of this morning's Providence Journal, and it has to do with this Women's Caucus raising money, setting agenda. They had the big fight with Steve Alves, even though that certainly died. He basically was saying pigs grunting and all this other stuff, and that was allowed to die. But they talk about the fundraising, and some of the women that they talk to, apparently they've raised over $10,000. The state party only has $60,000, but they've raised $10,000, and they say, you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat, da da da, and we're here for one reason, and we're here to elect women and push for women and issues that affect women. And that's, you know, we're here to support women, support legislation that supports women. It is certainly causing some infighting within the Democrat Party, trying to say that they do not in any way speak for the party. They're separate. But what are your thoughts on this very progressive, ultra-left women's caucus that has sprung up within the Democrat Party?
Well, I think that's exactly it. They're very progressive and ultra leftist. Right now, I think they're on the high of a kind of an identity politics initial surge, where you get this one woman, Melissa Devine from Newport, saying, "I'm a moderate Democrat, and they've radicalized me." You know, whether or not that's true, they can still say, "Oh, it's just women coming together to support women. That's what our group's about. That's our rationale. That's why we're different. That's why we should have been treated differently by the state party." But then they list, you know, women's issues. It's the whole, almost like we were talking about with Governor Raimondo a few minutes ago. It's the whole progressive list, you know, gun control, immigration, minimum wage. Everything's a women's issue, and everything is to the left. Everything's progressive. That can only last so long. I did think the fundraising amount was interesting. Particularly, Kathy Gregg of the Providence Journal said it's not far behind the $60,000 that the state party has. Well, I don't know. The difference between $10,000 and $60,000 is pretty substantial.
That's a lot. It is.
but you know, it's not. If you look at all the campaign finance numbers, and I haven't reviewed the Women's Caucus numbers yet, it's not that difficult to get up to $10,000. I mean, it's a few people giving the maximum, and you can take it from anywhere in the country. So a few of Governor Raimondo's, you know, progressive people from Michigan or wherever giving $1,000, and suddenly you're up there and you've got a caucus that can come out and say, we've got all this momentum behind us. So, I mean, we'll see over time whether they can continue to keep that going. I suspect it'll just fade back a little bit and be another interest group in the state, particularly as more moderate Democrats who might be swept up in this idea of the women's caucus focusing on women's issues start to actually look at what those issues are and say, yeah, I'm not on board with all of this, and pulling back their support a little bit. But we sure are seeing a lot of it starts to become suspicious, the overlap. And in fact, the state party contacted our federal delegation with some of this. This is not the Democrat Party. This is a group of left wingers, and kind of explicitly connecting it to the political co-op, Matt Brown's progressive group. So we're seeing a number of these kind of groups popping up, and I suspect that's not an accident. And what we're seeing is a well-funded attempt to affect Rhode Island politics, to force the Democrat Party in the state to go left even more than it is, as some kind of bellwether for the country, which would be terrible for Rhode Islanders.
No, you're exactly right. And on that note, Justin Katz, and again, folks, good afternoon. We'll speak with Justin Katz. Hello to everybody on Facebook Live. There's Joe Roberts and Dr. Lisa Wolf. Let's see, Jimmy and Rebecca Vocal and a lot more. What do you make of that Matt Brown cooperative where they had their press conference, and they want to follow the actions of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Justin Katz, who they're talking about, you know, high tax on high earners. When I've heard Matt Brown interviewed, I was very unimpressed. He talks in and this was when he announced the co-op You know, this whole thing, it's just phrases. It's, you know, working wage and working families and issues that matter to people. And doesn't really come out and say anything, doesn't address the fact that Rhode Island has people leaving the state, not coming in, leaving the state. And that new education commissioner, to her credit, when she was speaking and talked about regionalization, she said, you know, let's face it, that people, our population here is shrinking. It's not getting bigger. And you don't hear anyone say that. I found that a very interesting comment. I heard the governor's people were upset with her for even mentioning the fact that people are leaving and not coming in. And she was trying to say, hey, it makes sense to, you know, do communities to get together in high school, because let's face it, our population is declining around here. From what I was told, she was kind of called on the carpet because they don't like that narrative in any way. They try to put forth the narrative that people are in fact moving in. But the progressive co-op that they're talking about, this fight within the Democrat Party, Justin Katz, they are I'm very curious to see how what plays out nationwide. I saw a poll, I think it was a Fox News poll yesterday, and it has Joe Biden, former Vice President Biden, at 41%. Now, this was just a national poll. It had Bernie Sanders, I think it was around 33%. Elizabeth Warren at 30%. Now, as much as Biden is then, you know, in the lead outside the margin of error, if you take Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, that's 63% of the Democrat Party are on board with a socialist agenda. I think this next election, people, this is not Republican. I think is something that really needs to be explained. The ideas that they're putting forward of Matt Brown and that some of the others is cooperative, these are not Republican-Democrat debates. These people, like that Sam Bell, this is socialism. They believe in socialism. They don't believe in capitalism. They think it's negative. They don't want to tweak the way our country is. They want, as Bernie Sanders says, full-scale revolution, change, and turn everything upside down.
Which explains why they don't want to talk about the realities of their projects and why their people are leaving the state or have fewer and fewer students in high schools. Obviously, if you end up regionalizing, not only are you admitting that your people aren't investing in a state with their children or their families, you're also starting to close schools, which reduces the number of union jobs that are available.
That's right.
Another recent story was the number of people applying to be teachers or teacher programs like Rhode Island College and so on is down quite a bit across the country, but especially in Rhode Island. Those are all indications that your policies are not working. And that's what the progressive groups, I wrote about this with Sam Bell a week or two ago in the Providence Journal, They can just say anything. So they'll say, we want to essentially double the tax rate on high earners. And even Governor Raimondo was saying, no, you can't do that because people can just leave. The people who make that much money, over $400,000 a year, they can up and leave pretty easily. They're not stuck here. And even if they get another house somewhere else, I mean, think about that. If you're going to increase the rate on somebody who makes $400,000 a year, they could buy a house elsewhere to live half the year in a day,
yep,
and still save money,
yes,
versus the income on their taxes. I mean, it's childish thinking that the progressives are pushing, but they're not trying to persuade anybody who actually thinks things through. They've got their troops, and all the rest is political pressure they're trying to put on. And what it seems like to me, and this might even give them too much credit, but it seems almost like a juvenile attempt at negotiating. So, okay, we want to get our 6% up to 8%. So let's start at 12%. Yeah, that's how we'll do it. We'll pitch that first, and then we'll compromise somewhere between. And it's just not how it works, but it's also not how it ought to work in a public debate, because what you end up getting is nobody can ever be honest about what we're doing and what the purpose is and what we're trying to accomplish, which is why you end up with these terrible policies that aren't funding a government that's already over budgeted and losing population. That's why we're in this circumstance, because we're not having honest debates. It's all talking points and pressure from special interest groups.
And that's huge. And I think, you know, there is some attention on this. I think it's going to play out tonight in Warwick. They're supposedly going to sign in this new Warwick firefighters contract that, by all accounts, it's another example of Band-Aids. I'm resigned to the fact, Justin, that until things really crack apart, it's really just about appeasement. There's no leadership. Solomon maybe talked a big game. I think it's a Peter Principle. He's just, you know, you got to decide. You have to have a real... It just shows that some of the people who have tried to be reformers, you have to have a real backbone, how far and few in between they are. I can't even listen to a lot of the concepts when people start talking about Scott Evedige and Ripta because of the conditioning left that city that seemingly now no one even asks him about. But when we talk about, and you're exactly right, if you listen to the Sam Bells and the other progressives, it's always there's not enough money thrown at education. You know, you got to properly fund it. They don't care what the numbers are. They don't care about taxing. Elizabeth Warren, she was content to give these speeches about free Medicaid and everything until she started running for president. People start actually questioning the numbers and realizing that there's no way to pay for it. And I think that someone who I thought actually gave a good speech about the danger when you start to tax, quote, high earners, and it's really a war in vilifying successful and wealthy individuals. And it was actually Cuomo that said, he was talking to a group in New York, and he said, what many of you need to realize is many of these wealthy individuals that you want to impose all these taxes on, it is true they are some of the wealthiest people, but, and it's something you just mentioned, they also happen to be the most mobile people. I mean, most people that maybe live in a community, that's where they live, they can't afford to move somewhere else. These people, they could move in a drop of a hat, depending, and that did happen quite a bit in New York and New Jersey. And then just finally, how do you see the progressives at the State House shaping the debate going into next year? Because I think the State House is another atmosphere where, as this Matt Brown, you know, the drumbeat to the left, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Justin Katz, they are both standing very, very strong. We're gonna have to wait and see. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I mean, could, he hasn't gone away, heart attack or no heart attack, and Elizabeth Warren, they're not going anywhere. How they make out and work out in Iowa and New Hampshire, I think it's just going to fuel the locals at home that they don't want to talk about how to pay for things. They don't really live in reality. It's all about you just spend as much money as for any concept you come up with.
Yeah, well, there's never any accountability. As you said with Elizabeth Warren, sometimes at the national level, when you start to get on that stage and you're running for an actual powerful office like presidency, people start to actually say, okay, great idea, how are you going to pay for it? And that's a big problem we need to face in Rhode Island. How are we going to pay for these ideas? So I think as the progressives move into the election year and during a legislative session, a lot of it's going to depend on the feedback legislators and non-radical non-radical Democrats in Rhode Island, how much they get the message that actually a majority of the state's voters still live in reality. And to the extent that they are polling or just feedback they're getting from at the grocery store or wherever is, look, don't listen to those wackos. They're making a lot of noise, but everybody's actually going to vote for something more reasonable. That could show the whole progressive project to be what it really is, which is a highly funded outside organization of progressives, progressive activists. And if you look into some of the newer ones in the legislature, their husbands are all, you know, I'm thinking in East Greenwich in particular, Caldwell and Valverde, their husbands are paid activists at the national level, and they're in a General Assembly. So if that's who moderate Democrats think they're up against, and they think they still have the people's backing, then maybe we'll see some pushback on the progressives. And I don't think Raimondo's a good indicator here because she doesn't seem to care about Rhode Island so much anymore, and she's got a lot of that outside money as well. But that's going to be the question of the coming year.
And something to look for in the coming year, and again, folks, good afternoon. It's John DePizzo. I speak with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com, a high-level business owner, And you would know the name if I said it, but I won't betray the confidence. But it's interesting, Justin. He said that recently he was at a breakfast meeting with some other, and these are people that employ a lot of people, and they have a substantial stake in the state. And it was an informal gathering where someone got them all together and kind of got them together and said that he said there is debate amongst a lot of the business owners of, and the way he framed it to me was like, you're on the Titanic and a hole, you know, there's a hole. And the question is, do you try to plug the hole or do you make your way to the lifeboat? And they said that there is discussion amongst business leaders of the direction the state is going. Do you try to repair and improve the situation, or do you just start to make plans for your exit and realize that the more the progressives get power and lead the state in that direction, it's going to get more and more difficult? I heard an interesting statistic that when and it seems, you know, when, not if, the state loses a congressional seat, that could mean as much as $1 billion in federal funding. And the more that Cicilline pokes the eye of the president and everything else, can you imagine what the state would look like if suddenly there was $1 billion less federal funds coming in? I don't hear anyone discussing the possibility of what things would look like up on Smith Hill.
That would be disastrous. They rely on that so much. I think the mention of the business owners really points to something important in Rhode Island. We don't have the antibodies to fight back the virus that the
You're right.
has created, because we have, I mean, organizations that should be fighting them, that should be out there, like the Chamber of Commerce or those sorts of organizations, they're fully bought into Rhode Island's insider system. And so there's nowhere easy for these businesses to go to. I know there's in development at Gaspy Business Network that'll be something of an alternative to the chamber in that regard. But that's what's needed is voices actually representing these communities rather than doing what they've been doing, like the chambers have been doing, which is representing government's interests to those constituencies. It has to go the other way. And I guess we all should hope that there's enough critical mass of people who come up with the answer, no, we have to stay and at least fight for a few more, another decade. Hopefully there are enough of those that they don't all come up with their exit strategies within the next couple of years, because we're facing a lot of challenges and we'll hit rock bottom a lot more quickly if they all flee.
And one last thing, I think it's interesting, it's not highlighted enough, that when Governor Raimondo talks about a $200 million shortfall and just complaining about this just isn't enough money, there are other states around the country, Justin Katz, they have surpluses, and they have huge surpluses, and they cut taxes, and they fund different things, and it's just so removed from the norm. I think they just live in this vacuum. It does remind me of when there was a debate in the Senate about a couple of years ago, and they were trying to say that no other state has this provision. And I think it was that Senator Chacon or someone like that said, I don't care about these other states. This is Rhode Island that we're talking about. I think it was something with the firefighters or something like that. Folks, he is the managing editor at OceanStateCurrent.com. It's Justin Katz. Justin, great job. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, John. I look forward to the next one.
All right, folks. There it is. Justin Katz on this Political Monday.